Hello, everyone, and welcome back to RPG R&D. I am one of your hosts, Jess Geyer. I am one half of One of the Games, and I make almost exclusively political role-playing games. And I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Craig Campbell. Hello, Craig.
That's a strong message you have there, Jess.
It is.
I'm Craig Campbell. I'm the owner of Nerdburger Games. I also make role-playing games. Some of them also have political sides to them, messages within them, and things like that. I wonder why we're talking about that right here. Maybe maybe we'll introduce our guest and set us up for the episode here. Hello, Eddie. Welcome aboard.
Hi, my name is Eddie Webb, and I have notoriously worked on extremely apolitical games like Cyberpunk Red and Werewolf the Apocalypse.
No politics there.
No, not at all. Not at all.
But Eddie, thanks for coming on and joining us for this topic. It is obviously a topic that all three of us are familiar with. Craig, what are we talking about? I can't guess. I'm so...
We're talking about games with a message. And that's a pretty broad way to look at things, a pretty broad term. And we're going to talk about this kind of from, you know, GMing point of view and kind of, you know, adapting and using games that have messages in them. And also the idea of designing those sorts of things into your game. And these can be, I know that the tendency with people on the internet is to use the broad term political. It's all political. Mm-hmm. That's a very that's a kind of a specific word. It can also be sociological, and it can have to do with morality. Which isn't necessarily specifically political, but is more rooted in humanism and some cases religion and, you know, those sorts of things. So it's really kind of digging down a little bit into games and running games as a GM and designing games as a designer that have messages in them and being cognizant of those and how we can kind of bring those messages to bear.
Yeah, I mean, it's... Most of my games have a very specific, like politically specific message. However, like having those sociological messages too, like those exist in my games as well. I don't know. I feel a little bit different about how both of those are, like, not different, like how they're portrayed. I think that they're both totally fine to have in games, but like the way that you approach, whether it's like the type of message you're expressing, I think that is it's a little dance you have to do while you're writing a game, I would say. So let's kick it over to Eddie. Eddie, why did you choose this topic and what's your experience with it?
So I should start by, well one disclaimer is that I actually currently live in the UK. I have US UK citizenship, so I'm gonna have a slightly different political perspective on political stuff, but I self-identify as a punk and have for many decades now. I grew up as a skate punk. I have had confrontations with skinheads, you know, the whole nine yards. So for me, having games with messages is just kind of irreducible, right? It's very much a part of my makeup. But also, recently, I've been listening to Alan Moore, which is always, you know, he's a very good writer, but when you're talking to a bearded anarchist, you're coming from a certain perspective, right? he has this great online course on BBC Maestro about storytelling, which is basically a way to kind of 6 hours of how to learn how to be a writer, how to tell stories, so on and so forth. And like one of the first things he says is like, know what your political leanings are and, you know, make sure that you're aware of them. It was really interesting to me. He then follows up by saying, and realize those are going to change over time. Which is slightly less relevant. But he said something that I think a lot of people try to articulate and maybe have trouble with, is that all art is ultimately has a message. All art ultimately has a political slant, because we are people and people draw messages out of art. If something makes you engage, makes you think, it is inherently going to convey some kind of message. And if you are not careful about what that message is, you're going to end up getting an extremely different message than you intended across. Mm-hmm. So I've always felt like Knowing what your intentions are when you go in as a game master, as a designer, whatnot, are vital, because otherwise people are going to take very, very different things away from it.
Yes, absolutely. That's the pitfall of being unintentional with your work and thinking like, oh no, there's no message in my game. This is just a cute little game about traveling to other places and looting ancient temples. Okay, yeah, great. Maybe put a little bit more thought into that. Maybe think, because if you don't think about it, someone else is going to think about it for you. And like you said, people are going to get a different message out of it. Sometimes that can be like, wow, this person actually, like, the politics in this are really crappy. Like, the message here is like, what are they even trying to say? Or even worst case scenario, you get people who misinterpret your message for their own nefarious evil purposes. Like, oh, suddenly, like, why do all of these skinheads like my music? I don't understand. Is not the kind of that's not the kind of art you want to produce. If you're listening to this podcast and you want to produce that kind of art, stop, turn off this podcast and go.
The roll of newspaper. No, bad, bad, bad. But yeah, and I mean, like, particularly if you're running a game, because we're gonna, and I know this is the structure of the show. We start with kind of the running the game side of things. It is also okay if you run a game with people who generally align with your ideology to reinforce that ideology. I mean, because on some level, if you want, if you're running a game for people who really wanted to have very kind of liberal leanings, and they want to explore those, that's okay, as long as everyone's aware of kind of what's going on. And but also understand that you're also not going to have control over how necessarily people are going to pull things from your game. And having good conversations with your group will help with that. A great example, you mentioned really cute games. Pugmire, game about dogs in a sci-fi world who think it's fantasy world, and they beat up, demons with battle axes, and it's cute and adorable. One of my very first play tests of the game, when I was still designing it, I ran it for a group of people who'd never seen the game before, no idea what was going on with it. And the premise was, a cat gets arrested for a crime in a dog town. The dogs arrest him, and his dog accomplice more or less gets let off, but the cat keeps getting grilled. And so the player characters are drawn in to kind of get some information to help exonerate the cat. And they do so, and the cat is grateful at the end. At the end, thank you so much, gave me their feedback. One person kind of hung behind and said, "Did I just play a game about racial profiling?" And yes, I did do that intentionally. I wanted to see if anyone picked up on it, because I wanted to test if Pugmire as a game could communicate these messages, if people would pick them up, or if I was overthinking it. The answer was clearly no, I was not overthinking it. Someone did get what I was laying down. And my argument then and now is that funny animal stories have been telling us morality since as long as we have been telling stories about funny animals. Aesop's
Aesop,
Fables,
man.
lots of
La
mythologies. Yeah.
Fontaine. Yeah.
Yeah. But even like Donald Duck comics, I mean, all of them tell us something about ourselves. And so because I went into that, I did it in a way that if people did not want to engage with that, they didn't have to, because dogs and cats hate each other, and that's a very understandable concept. It doesn't involve pulling that message out. But someone did, and they were very happy and receptive that I had put that message in there and done it in a very tactical way. So I mean, if you have a group, and this is just standard content stuff, like if you have a group that you know are not going to be receptive to a particular message, be aware of that. I'm playing in a Call of Cthulhu game right now, and one of the players is black, and so we're having a very strong conversation about 1920s language around the black experience. And it's okay, let's, maybe not use some of these words in these circumstances, use some of these words in other circumstances. And we're having a very long talk about it, and we're having, and the thing is that we can still engage with this stuff as part of the conversation. Explain, like, you could put emphasis on certain relatively mundane words and still get across if someone's being racist, if someone has ill intent towards black characters. You don't have to drop the N word to do that. And so we as a group decided we were more comfortable to just kind of let the racism come out in action rather than in vocabulary. Other
Yeah,
groups may be very
that's
comfortable with that, you know?
so important to have that session one, or session zero, session zero. Why am I saying session one?
Session,
Like, wow,
all
all
sessions,
sessions.
all
That's
sessions.
true. That's true, especially if you're dealing with something super heavy like that. And if for lighter messages, like if this is a morality play about like the dangers of not listening to your parents, is the first message I can think of. Like, we're doing a Red Riding Hood, you know. Like, even having a discussion about something like that up front, like, hey, this is kind of the theme we're playing at. When you have those discussions up front too, not only are you going to make your players more comfortable at the table, but you're also going to get them to role play in a certain way. Setting up those expectations, like, this is a game, like, this is a game with a message. The message is about treating each other in a caring way in society. And discuss that. Like, we're going to explore, like, what's it like to treat people with empathy in a society that doesn't really care about you. You're going to see that the players like interact with that theme more and in a more intentional way, or sometimes even subconsciously, just because you've had that conversation up front. It's going to make for a more valuable experience with the game if that is something that you're going in with intentionally. Even like a conversation like, this game is not about this, like, with your own table groups too, having these conversations is easier than with a group of strangers, for example. But I've often found it to be really useful. For example, when me and my buddies are playing a Pokemon-esque game right now, but the world is like a mo like a an alternative America where there's a lot of corruption and the government sucks. And knowing that up front, like, hey, this is the kind of theme, this is the kind of politics we're engaging with, kind of gives us the go-ahead to do the actions that you would do in a world like that. Like, oh yeah, we're like little rebels with Pokemon. Sure, great. Yeah, I get it now. I know what I can do. I know what you want me to do, and it makes me more confident as a player to play in a game like that.
And there's something to be said for, you know, as a GM, just kind of keeping in mind that, and I'll use Eddie's example of the cat and dog game session, where there are going to be players who perhaps when they play a role-playing game, they want to turn off their real-world analytical brain and just enjoy a fun little game about cats and dogs doing some stuff. And they're not going
Absolutely.
to pick up like Katie said, like, you know, one player hung back to ask the question, the other ones might have been thinking it, and other ones, or even be sure of it, and other ones might have, it may not have registered for them. And that's okay. Like, some people, everybody engages with games in different ways. So, especially with, if you're running a game where the messaging is subtle, or if you're running a game or a particular adventure where the messaging is subtle, you know, it's okay if that's the case. In some cases, people are actively seeking that. They're analyzing, like, that's part of their fun of playing a game, is seeing, you know, like, well, what are they really talking about? Like Jess and I talk about in the game, what's the game about? What's the session about? Well, what's it really about? You know, in Eddie's game, it was, well, the game is about, you know, like, rescuing this cat from peril. But what's it really about? Well, we know what that was. And then there's, you know, all variations in between that. There's going to be people that are going to pick up on certain things because it's, those things are intrinsic to their experience, so they're very hyper aware of certain situations, or they have partners or friends or parents or whatever who are, you know, see those things come up in real life often, so they're more aware of things. And they're going to be people that, you know, maybe just aren't as aware, and they might pick it up in one game but not in another. And all of that is perfectly fine. Like, as a GM, I don't think it's a terribly good idea to try to beat the message into people. You know, there's nothing wrong with saying at the end of it, like, you know, kind of looking at the group and saying in tongue in cheek, you know, and then that game was sort of a game about racial profiling. And some people will go, oh, okay. And that doesn't diminish anybody's enjoyment of the moment, of the time spent playing the game. They still had fun, you know, rescuing the cat from peril. But, you know, it there there's a difference between, one of the things we had in our little topic blurb when we were talking about this topic was, you know, not being heavy-handed. You know, the difference between having symbolism and allusion to things versus like getting really, really heavy with it. And there are games that do that. There are games that are very, very like this game is about this thing. Bluebeard's Bride comes to mind as a game that it's about a very specific sort of thing about gender power dynamics, patriarchy. And if you play that game without those things in it, you're really not playing that game anymore. But there are games that have subtle little things in them, and all of them can be equally enjoyable. Different groups will be interested in engaging with different games like that. Like some game groups aren't just built, aren't cut out to play something that's really, really overtly message laden. That's not what they're looking for in playing a game. Other groups will embrace it. And then some players will be like, I didn't think I was going to be into this kind of thing, but I was with my friends. I trusted them. I gave it a shot and I found myself really getting into it and I learned something. And I found some insights. Or maybe it revealed something to me about myself that I didn't really know. And now I'm maybe a little uncomfortable with, but now I've got something I can work on.
No, totally. I
I
mean,
think.
I know at conventions, particularly when I was explicitly the Vampire the Masquerade line developer, I had people coming to me and they would say things like, in the course of playing Vampire the Masquerade, I discovered that I was transgender, or I discovered, something about my sexuality that I did not realize before. So I mean that is certainly, you can discover a lot by challenging yourself on these fronts. But I think you're a very good point. Like, if the game is wearing its politics on its sleeve, wearing its message on its sleeve, like if you're playing Harlem Unbound, you're playing for a very specific experience, right? So everyone knows what that experience is going in. And so as long as it is possible to get that wrong, but as long as everyone's on the same page, you can kind of recover from that, as it were. The more subtle you get with messaging, the more you have to accept that you're going to occasionally inadvertently upset people. And that's where sometimes I worry about people who say things like, my games aren't political. It's like they are. But you can occasionally give a message that you intend to give, tangibly, give something that implies that you believe something that you don't. And then just have a conversation about that. It's okay to mess up. And also, situations change, right? A perfect example of this is back in the late 90s, I played a lot of Vampire the Masquerade live action. And so in the late 90s, I thought it'd be really cool and fun to play as myself, in live action, a half Japanese, half white terrorist. Over the years, I have learned that was a really bad thing to do, but certainly, in 2001, I really didn't want to play that character anymore. And the messages I was sending didn't necessarily change. I learned more what I was sending and did not like what I was putting out into the world as a result. And so it is okay to recognize, oh, I didn't mean that, and either change how your game is going or just shut it down, right? It's like, oh, listen. I realize where this is going and I don't like it. Go back to Pokemon, actually, is a really good example. Not that Jess's game is doing this, but the Pokemon franchise, the video game franchise. I remember talking about it with a video game designer 5, 6 years ago, and they were getting very kind of tight-lipped and arms crossed and lots of body language. They didn't want to talk about it. So, I'm sorry, am I bothering you talking Pokemon? I'm like, what about Pokemon bothers you? And it's like, I just don't really dig on dog fighting simulators.
Oh.
And I'm like, and at first I was like, but it's, and I started thinking about it. It's like, it really is, isn't it? You capture animals against their will and then force them into fights on a regular basis. And it's like, I'm certain that was not the intended message that the Pokemon designers ever wanted to give, but that is a valid message that someone received.
And that's the thing about, and this kind of touches into the design aspect of it, is like Eddie was saying, being cognizant of the choices that you're making about what you're putting in there. The more you don't think about what you're putting into your game, the more potential there is that somebody is going to extrapolate something that you did not intend just by accident, because you combined a few different elements in a subtle way, and those things just resonated with this person or with this, group of people or whatever, and they end up coming away with a particular message. That's it's the beauty and the danger of art, right? Art can elicit a lot of responses from people, and as Eddie made a comment at the beginning, you can't control how people interpret the art.
Caveat,
You
you
can
can.
skew it of what?
I said caveat, you can. You can control how people interpret your art by what kind of symbols you do, the actual plot of the narrative, the symbols that you add, like I think I already said symbols, the characters you put in. If, for example, Pokemon, are you actually let's take the anime for example. Are you actually capturing animals outside of their will? Not really. The Pokemon are portrayed as pretty happy in that episode, or in that series. They're portrayed pretty happily. They're generally treated well. Is it a dog fighting simulator? Well, no, number two, none of the animals die. Number three, they're not real animals. They're character representations. Number four, the tone of it. The tone of this entire series is more happy. It's not brutal. There's no gore, for example. All of those things, had I included in the game and made a much more expressive, like dog fighting simulator, quote unquote, like sure, yeah, you could totally. And I'm not saying that that interpretation isn't valid. You're more than welcome to like not like a thing because it reminds you too much of one thing or another. However, I do believe like when. The way you read something, you have to also like pull in other clues. Like those are the ways you can control a narrative. Same thing with
I will argue that the word you're looking for perhaps is influence, not control. You can't be 100%. I'm sorry, you just can't.
I assume sure.
Eddie's example is an example of exactly that. Somebody
Sure.
extrapolated something based on incomplete information and their own personal feelings about a number of things, including dogfighting.
You can't control, but you can't ignore it when they have something completely out of pocket. Just like, I mean, you can. Like, you don't have to. Like, the problem with making, especially like a political game, if you are so focused on like, oh, what if they interpret it this way or this way, you will never finish your game. You're not
That
like
I'll agree with. That's
there's
a
no
fair
such
point.
thing as a perfect politics on that. And I think that like there are always going to be people who want to find a fault because they're contrarian and they're not happy with anything. You're always going to have those people, and you can't write a game for those people. However, you do have to be intentional on the other side. You do have to be intentional that you're not like doing something blatant, which is why it's important to make sure, like, if you are writing a game about like Zootopia, for example, like if you're writing a Zootopia style game where different animals are classed different ways and there's also a cop, like maybe think about that message a little bit before you finish that product, maybe get some other perspectives on it. But you can't constantly be worrying about, I mean, I've seen this happen. It's especially prevalent online. There are always going to be people who are going to like find a fault with something, even if that's not your intention.
Absolutely.
And, you know, like that's, you can't have a perfect politics. It doesn't exist.
And that's, I think that's what I was trying to get at, is that there is no way to control it perfectly. You can influence certainly. Just as a creator of any art, it's worthwhile keeping in mind that there will always be some people who will, potentially interpret what you've laid down in a different way, just through their own personal biases and so forth. And confirmation bias, which is a big driver of people's opinions on a lot of things, is like, I believe this particular thing, so now I'm going to find that thing in your game, in your art.
Right.
No matter how, I mean, no matter how obscure and unintentional it was. You're much likely less likely to have this problem if you're playing a game with a group of people that know your intentions and know what you're going for. You're less likely to have that, and you're also less likely to have it if you're open and upfront with it in the first place. You're more likely to have this if you're sharing it with a bunch of strangers with no context.
Which is actually is a valid point, is that if you're running, say, a convention game, you have to be a little more clear about what your overall thrust is going to be, because you're probably playing with strangers as opposed to playing with your local group. You may not have to worry as much because you may be familiar with the players. Like, okay, I know kind of where we're on the same page, so I maybe don't have to talk about these concepts as much, but it's still worth talking about because they may surprise you. And it's good to kind of be aware of that. But so, I mean, I see, definitely see your point, Jess, and I agree with a lot of it. Certainly, one example I can think of for Pugmire is I had a writer who asked to write an adventure, and the adventure was based around a bunch of rats who were doing nefarious things, and they wanted to try to take over this chunk of Pugmire's crime area. And I was okay, sounds like a good concept, let's dig into it. But then when I got the manuscript back, there was a lot of posters around, all depicting rats. Every single rat character was evil and dirty. And then they all were very money grubbing. And a lot of the posters had things like, watch out for long noses and whatnot. And I was like, okay, this is really heavily moving into anti-Semitic territory because you're using a lot of anti-Semitic symbolism. And they really unaware of it. They had no, they didn't. And so I pointed out, and then I was like, oh my God, they were horrified when I pointed it out. And we were able to clear it up. It's okay, just have a few rats that are sympathetic and let's pull some of this language out and rearrange it so that way we can still keep the vibe is that you have a rat crime family, but not everyone is money grubbing. Not everyone is dirty. Not everyone lives in the slums. Not everyone's living in a special part of the city that is, limited to them. Let's take all of these symbols out, mix them up, and then we get a much stronger, better story out of it. So to your point, yes, absolutely, you can control being aware of those symbols and making sure you're explicitly trying to break them down and redirect them, so that way you're reducing the amount of people who will walk away with that experience is certainly a very strong way to go. But I agree with Craig that, like, some people are just gonna walk away, and bad faith arguments exist, bad faith readings exist, but also two people can look at the exact same thing and have very different takeaways. And Star Trek is my go-to example, right? Like, Star Trek infamously, iconically, was meant to be extremely liberal utopian show. It's like, the first black white kiss, and it's everyone, money is gone, is anti-capitalist paradise because money has been absolved and all of this. But also, a lot of extremely conservative people also really love Star Trek, and they look at that and they see people with a strong will, with a good intentions, are making sure that other people conform to their ideological standpoints. That a common status quo where humanity is ultimately in charge, but still lets people do what they want to as long as they fall within certain constrained viewpoints. It is possible to read Star Trek also as heavy conservative ideology. It's not clearly not the intent of the writers, but that is what some people choose to bring to it, and that's what they take away from it. People will reinforce their own viewpoints. So I completely agree. The reason why I bring all this stuff up is because you can't control that, so don't bother. Do the best you can to remove things that you know are going to distract from the messages you want to give, and clear the field, and then recognize that there's still things out there. Just accept them as they are and do your best as you learn.
The rats example is a perfect example of what I was trying to get at. Like, if you have all of this stuff, like, yes, it's this and also this and this and this and this, clearly you need to go back and rethink some things. But if it's this, it's rats and nothing, none of the other stuff, like, it's you're clearly signaling what your intentions are for your art that you're creating. I think just, yes, maybe control is not the right word. However, I get a little touchy about blue curtains conversations on the internet
Yes, curtains are
as a
fucking
former
blue.
English teacher, because we do put intent, we do put authorial intent into writing, and like we can't just make wild interpretations based off of nothing. But like I said, this is it's very rarely a problem. The only times I've ever seen this, like, actually, like, people are like, wow, the politics, the message on this really sucks, is when, like, it does actually really suck. But I've seen some interesting critiques of other products too, that I'm like, I think that you are reading something into this which Again, great conversation to have. What can you do to avoid that? But
And I think there's some value, right, in recognizing this stuff. And also there's value in critiquing things a little bit aggressively in order to get people to think about stuff. I'm going to show this, which I don't understand makes great audio. There's a fantastic book called Ways of Seeing by John Berger. It's written in the 70s. And it's the book that one of the early books that start to codify what we now call the male gaze, right? So it's a lot of talking about why female nudes were so popular at a certain point in time in art history. And ultimately, the argument the book makes is it's about possession. Because the way that the women are framed and painted in these oil paintings and whatnot is specifically to look directly at the person looking at the painting, to invite them in to try to make them realize that whatever's happening in this scene, I'm looking at you, the viewer, and I am acknowledging that I am a possession of yours. And then the book then goes on, it's like, other art critics have not come to this point, have not come to this view, and have given lots and lots of reasons for centuries as to other reasons why paintings go this way. Berger makes the argument of they're all wrong, but I think the real answer is there are lots of different ways to interpret stuff. There are reasons why, like I read a feminist's interpretation of Beowulf, and it's very different poem when translated from a feminist perspective as opposed to some of the other Beowulf translations, and they all put their own spin on it. So thinking about this stuff helps me to understand Beowulf better. I don't have to agree with that interpretation, but it does help me to kind of understand the art I'm looking at better. So I think it's point like as you're designing these games and looking at other games, looking at them and go like there are a few examples that are explicitly just hateful, horrible things, don't bother. But many others, like if you look at a game that is maybe different from you ideologically, still looking at it and going, okay, can I pull interpretation out of this and help to understand my own design better? Or why does this game make me feel like this way? Why do they feel this way when they play this game? What about this game is making them feel that way? How can I do that slash avoid that in my own designs?
I mean, bringing that back to the game running conversation, being a GM, like you can do that with your GMing too. Like
True, yeah.
you could take a game, like let's say we're gonna play, what's a game that's on my bookshelf that I've played recently? I don't want to use D&D right now. I don't want to. Where's
So
my
easy.
bookshelf? We're gonna play, Wander Home. We're going to play
Okay.
Yzeba's Bed and Breakfast. Let me do that one because I'm more familiar with Yzeba's. We're going to play Yzeba's Bed and Breakfast. And we are, I'm thinking of all these themes that like Jay Dragon actually just puts in there. we're going to really, like, I'm going to pull out all of these like anti-capitalist themes from it. Like, that's the thing I want to focus on. I want to look at this from an anti-capitalist lens, or I want to look at it from a feminist lens, or I want to look at it from a queer lens. And like thinking about what lens you want to put on this game and interpret it on as the GM lets you kind of interpret, even something like the Zebas, where you have a set cast, you have like set little episodes that you're playing through. You can then like kind of like bring out those themes in a different way, and that can be a really enriching experience. And you can do that with any game. Like you can certainly do it with a game like Vampire the Masquerade. You could certainly do it with
Totally.
a game like Dungeons and Dragons, even. You could pull out different themes and look at it from different ways. I've certainly run feminist D&D games and anti-capitalist D&D games and pro-capitalist D&D games. I've run the gamut. So
Yeah, I remember one time I was talking to I believe it was Justin Achille at the time, one of the other designers on Vampire, certainly, and talking about a lot of the themes of Vampire the Masquerade. And I just kind of threw up there. It's like for me, Vampire Masquerade was always about alcoholism, and I kind of just stopped the room. And so I had to kind of explain. But like for me, vampire ultimately is a drug addiction metaphor, right? Alcoholism is the one that hit me the most. That's the one I go to, and also because it's a liquid, so it's a very natural connection. But like it's something that you need, something you know it's bad for you, but you still keep going after because you know that you need it, and you don't want to need it, but you still do. And that's something that I very intentionally put into my work, something I don't intentionally when I run games, because I know that there are very few people in the world that go to Vampire the Masquerade. It's like, I really want to explore the problems with alcoholism in this game about beating people up and taking their blood powers. I know that's not what most people want to come to the game for, but when I design the game, I certainly do lace that in, right? That's something that's important to me. Similarly, there are other games, like you said, I am writing right now, working on a game for some friends of mine of Cyberpunk Red, and I specifically want to be about a community building game. It's like, I don't want to do yet another your team of mercenaries taking jobs where you inevitably get screwed over by your corporate clients, because I'm living that right now. So, as a freelancer who's been screwed over by corporate clients, kind of don't want to do that in my game too. So instead, I want to do it about community building. What happens when the corporations leave you high and dry? And what can you build from the ashes? That seems something that's a more resonant to me and to the people I'm playing with now. But it's pretty easy to slide a game like Cyberpunk into something like that. Every game, you can slide that theme around. And that's kind of where, to go back to our earlier point, the catch-22 of making games are, like Jack just said, it's like you can't control what everyone pulls away from it, because someone's going to take your game, they're going to put their own message into it, they're going to slide it around a bit, and some other player's going to go, oh, that's what this game is about, even though that's not at all what you meant about that game to do.
Let's talk a little bit about game design too, specifically. I mean, we've
Okay.
talked a lot about like interpreting messages. Like, what are those moves that we can particularly make as a game designer that tightens up the interpretation that we want to get across, or that maybe doesn't, maybe leaves it a little looser for a message that we have that people can interpret in through different lenses. So what are some strategies that the three of us have used on the past? Mine was putting the anarchist symbol on the front on my front cover.
Subtle, subtle.
I think, metaphor for, taking things from the world, things that are, whether it's in the modern day and in current political climates or sociological conventions or whatever, or looking at history and how things were at a particular time, or looking at how things have changed and evolved over time, and kind of symbolizing that without changing too much, like changing the names. It's like, or scraping the serial number off, right? It's like, it's here, this game is th about this thing, but I just kind of scraped the serial number off and I changed the names to protect the innocent. I feel like, and maybe th this isn't necessarily broadly the case, but it for me, I have found that taking something that is part of the real world, either mod t today or historically, and just tw twisting it just enough to be like, oh, now it's this game element that has to do with like superpowers, or this game element that has to do with what happens if a society collapses, but without going too far afield that the metaphor kind of gets lost, where if you change too many things, it starts, and there's nothing wrong with being that subtle, with going really far afield, but I think with it helps to perhaps just shift a bit, but still keep it kind of grounded in, like, well, this is, somebody's reading the game and is going to be like, oh, this is based on this thing, or this is based on that thing, but they tweaked it to be this some other thing. You could say, like, Game of Thrones, for example, borrows and tweaks just a bit a number of different things that happened in British history. And then,
What
throws in
grows is
dragons
now?
and weird blood magic, and
I thought that was real. I thought that's
that
going to
would happen.
happen.
I live here. No, it's totally true.
ice zombies and so forth. But it, you know, there's there's
Wonderful.
there's there are events that take place that are like, oh, this is like, this character is, we just changed this ruler's name into this name, or we just changed this particular person, this historic personage into this name, and just made it like, and now it's, they have husbands instead of wives, or they have, like, they modified a few things. And so anybody who's familiar enough with the history is going to be like, oh, that's a metaphor for this, and that's like, oh, that's related to that. Like right now, working on Cosmic Corsairs, there's a point where I had to write setting material that was like, in the game, it's a science fiction game, where there's a dark regime, kind of a totalitarian regime that controls much of the solar system. And so there's, you know, certainly shades of Star Wars and, you know, in other similar stories in there. But there are literally, like, I went through and I was like, I watched Andor with a notebook in my hand and made little notes about, like, oh, this is a thing that happens when you're living under a totalitarian regime. Not because I didn't know from the real world, but because it gave me the opportunity to enjoy this piece of art and, but also be like, oh, these are things that happen when you're living under, you know, curfews and people just disappear. And like, I just made this whole list and it was like 2 pages of notebook notes of just like weird little things that happen. And so that little list of things got consolidated and modified a little bit and put into the game is like, these are the things that you as a GM can present in the game as like, this is what it's like for your character living in this world. And then looking at like, well, what are the things that the government does that is oppressive? And I was doing the same thing with Andor, some with the real world, where I was literally making lists of like, well, these are things that have literally historically happened on this planet, in this country, or other countries. And you know, just, you know, like I said, changing the names, but people will recognize it. They'll be like, oh, like these actions that this you know, the triarchy, as it's called, is the actions that they're taking is like, it's analogous to this other thing. And so it puts you in the frame of mind of like, okay, this is a game about living with and fighting back against a regime like that, which is presented in the game book as being very, very bad. And that's my message. But the, you know, it's the book is stricken, you know, the setting portion of the book is just stricken through with many, many examples of like, this is bad. This is like living like this is bad, and you should fight back against it. You should not have to live this way. So that's kind of the approach that I took for some of the things that I've done. There's other ones that are more obscure, like Code Warriors was like, oh, it's a perfect society. Everybody's a program. All the programs work perfectly. The society functions exactly how it's supposed to. And then it all starts to fall apart and nothing works the way it's supposed to. And I give you the toolbox of, you know, the tools to, you could, if you play the game, rebuild society in some way. You could decide, I'm going to re my characters are going to be take the forefront of rebuilding a better society. That perhaps isn't so classist and structured as the old society was, because it was effectively a classist society. You know, it draws on things that have happened when certain societies broke down historically, or just from your imagination of like, what would happen if like this perfectly ordered, albeit kind of classist society broke down and people had the opportunity to try to rebuild?
Yeah. For my end, like, I wish I had the wish I had the I won't say the ability. I wish I had the good luck, the good fortune to be able to just directly tell my reader, hey, this is what this game's about. I am in awe of Chris Spivey, for example, because like one of the first sentences in Heartland Unbound is every character in this book is black unless stated otherwise, and that is a very simple sentence that tells you everything you need to know about that book and makes it very clear what this book's about. And he'll be upset if he ever hears this because he's very bashful about this and feels like it's not that big of a deal. I think it is a groundbreaking sentence in a role-playing game book, frankly. And I've seen another one that comes to mind is Cyborg, which basically says, if you have any sympathy with the police or corporations, that is against the rules of this game. I mean, it's extremely aggressive on that. For me, I generally have lent more towards because my writing is a lot of times in horror and comedy, which are very, very closely linked. So I tend to slide towards satire, which both horror and comedy do really well, and use satirical language and structures. But one time on Pugmire, I realized that if you're doing a fantasy game about kings and princesses, ultimately, you do have to engage with biological family politics, you know, because a family needs to breed heirs, and that ties into dog breeding. And so, like, that was a piece that I felt like there was a strong tonal connection, but I knew even at the very beginning that I was going to have to address queer readings of the game, and so I just said, "The heck with it! I have a." A narrator throughout the book, Yosha Pug. She's a very sweet, somewhat naive character who thinks the best of people. And so I had her more or less address the reader, which is something she'd done throughout the book, so it wasn't unusual. And I said, some people have said that people have read the readings of humanity and determined that only certain kinds of dogs can live together and be in love. And that's just not true in my experience. I can't think that man would ever stop us from loving. So all dogs of all kinds can find love in all sorts of different ways. And that is what humanity wants from us, as I believe. Many years later, I go to TV Tropes website, and someone has written an entire page, well, an entire section of the page about how weird it is to be lectured by a pug about queer people existing. And I'm like, so the
Stop.
one time I actually say, hey, this game is welcoming to queer people, I get yelled at on TV Tropes for doing that.
Stop. Really? Oh
Yeah.
my gosh.
And I'm like, cool. This website's dead to me. So like I have had bad luck when I tell people, hey, this game is about this, because I've genuinely had people tell me that's not true. A colleague of mine who worked at White Wolf back in the day just said, hey, just so everyone knows, we were writing politically about Werewolf the Apocalypse back when the game first came out. I was there, I was one of the creators on it. That was definitely intention. And someone straight up online said, no, you didn't. You didn't put politics in the game. It's like, I'm telling you, I did. I was there. I did it. And I try to chalk that up to what Jess says of the you can't please everybody. And sometimes you do need to directly address the audience. But even when I was on Dystopia Rising, which is a post-apocalyptic zombie game, I pretty early on was like, okay, so this is going to be a game about disability on some level. And my logic and my reasoning for it was, in zombie movies, people are always losing hands, losing legs, losing limbs, losing the ability to move. They become sick, they become ill, they become chronically ill, sometimes fatally ill. And that is a way that people, because of the code and tropes around zombie movies, that is an acceptable way to talk about these kinds of things that people won't feel weird about. So we talk about disability, disability aids, assistive devices. What it's like to live with these things, and also be very clear that basically, unless everyone at the table is okay with your disability impacting your dice rolls, we assume it doesn't. Because disabled people are just as badass as anybody else. And again, like someone online was like, I didn't come to a zombie game to lecture about disability, and it's like, then what movie genre are you a fan of? Right. But again, that's my reading on it. I'm disabled. I have hearing loss. So to me, this is important. And I can't see the genre without this metaphor. Other people clearly do. So for me, like, I feel like I always have to be working in metaphor, in satirical language, at a remove, because I feel like otherwise it doesn't get out there. Because every time I put the fence up saying, it's about this, people go, nah, it ain't. So I struggle with that.
Here's another example, something that came up pretty recently on Rascal News about that, like a different reading into something. Okay, so there's a role-playing game, Good Society. Good Society purposefully, like it portrays in the game, this is something you should do as a game designer if you want to kind of have this message, purposely portrays in the game queer relationships and relationships between people of different races as well. So, but it's also a Jane Austen role-playing game at its heart, which is in the middle of colonial Britain. I mean, it's still a colonial power, but and then Thomas Manuel, I think that that's how I should pronounce his last name. On Rascal posted an article, and in it talks about feeling a little discomfort playing a game like this, where like okay, I am a person of color playing this game that is set where like it's hard to kind of find the I just dropped my book, hard to find the joy in playing this game when this was a colonial force that colonized my people. Like I can see how that might be a little bit that would give you a different coloring on that, like a different, like a different lens on that. And then making sure as a game designer that like if you I think perf it's perfectly fine having a like fourth wall breaking moment with the reader, like, hey, this is what we're trying to do. We don't want you to do this. We recognize this. I think that's a
Right, this is the
perfectly,
fantasy of Jane Austen. We're not talking about the actual history.
And I mean, it's still valid to not like want to play a game like that if that's not what you want to do and deal with. You don't want to think about that. Sure, great. But that's a move you can pull as a game designer. Say, hey, we recognize this. Here's what we're doing here. Like with Moonpunk specifically, we didn't want to have like aliens that inhabited the moon, which is a one of the sci-fi tropes, you know. Like we didn't want there to be people already living on the moon. We didn't want there to be an indigenous population there, because
Right.
that would then we would have to really think more intentionally about that. That's not a theme that we wanted to explore. So that was left out of the game. And we, you know, our message in that game is pretty clear. With Means of Magic, like same thing. We had a lot of like explicit discussions about like what are you doing in this game? Is it okay to be violent against people who are working for these corporations? In which ways is it okay to be violent with them? Like those are like things that we explicitly have and also implicitly have in the book, just having those messages specifically written down. And then it's harder for people to say like, hey, you didn't think about this. It's harder for you to be, it's harder for them to like accuse you of at least of not having at least thought about it. Gosh, that would drive me nuts if someone said like, I don't know. I don't know what I would do if I had a message like that.
I know, and like again, like as sometimes you, I mean, maybe I need to honestly be more explicit because you think a game is pretty clear, and it's just not. I keep going back to Werewolf the Masquerade, or sorry, Werewolf the Masquerade, Werewolf of the Apocalypse, because it is so explicitly an anti-capitalist, anti or pro-environmental game. I mean, where the back cover of the very first book is like Mother Earth is dying. I mean, it's like it's not at all subtle about what it's talking about, and yet there are still noteworthy amount of people, like more than just one or two, but like at least several dozen I've seen so far in my life, who genuinely feel like now, today, Werewolf has just gotten around to maybe addressing that maybe corporations are bad, even though it's been happening since 1992, right?
Right.
So like sometimes you do need to do that, but again, like I come back around to your point, Jess, of like sometimes maybe it's like maybe this game isn't for you then, like if you play this game and that's the message you take out of it, I can't design for stupid. I can't design for aggressively unintentional readings of my work. At some point in time, I have to say, this is just the game is what it is. But certainly, if there's an area where I am worried the game will, again, like with Pugmire, I was worried that people look at that and go, oh, it's a game about breeding, and it's just like, okay, that's. Yes, but also no. Like the joke is that is a thing that a stupid thing that we as humans put on dogs, and I want to kind of specifically deconstruct that on some level through the language of fantasy gaming. But I recognize that fantasy gaming has a pretty heavy weight on it. And this was 2016, before a lot of the modern discussion around the tropes of fantasy gaming really being dug into. And even then, I made some decisions the first edition because I thought gamers wouldn't be amenable to talking about things like racial bonuses, for example. I had a version of that in Pugmire first edition, and as soon as I realized people were keen to get rid of that, I said, cool, great, second edition, it's out. I never wanted it there to begin with, but I felt like I had to have it in on some level. So I've learned and I've grown and I've changed and adapted. So like, as you make more games, your position on this will change and go ahead. But
Society will change too. Like things that are
right.
acceptable or unacceptable, or like the ways that we think about things and have discussions about things, the education we have on different subject matters will also change too.
Yeah, but I'm with you. Like I personally feel like it is okay to just tell people, listen, this game ain't for you. I have certainly, again, not in my games, but I've had conversations online where people have said things like, I want to play Pugmire and I want to do this thing with it, and I've just gone, if you want to buy it, if you want to do that, I can't stop you. I legally can't send them to your house. I would rather you steal my book than give me money because I don't want your money if you're going to be that hateful with it. And I've had people shocked that I would say that, and it's like there's this capitalist conceit that artists sometimes have of like I have to be as many people as possible. I have to be as broad as possible to attract as many people as possible because I make more money that way. And I would love to say my reasons for pushing back on that were always based on sound financial theory. No, I'm just a hard-headed punk and sometimes tell people to go screw themselves. But over time,
Same.
I have learned that if you find your people, people who are on the fence about your book are more likely to get it if they see themselves in it. And knowing that people that they don't like are not going to be getting into it. And ultimately, worst case scenario, I feel like that nets out. The people you lose will be offset by the people you gain. But more often, you gain even more people because that word will spread. I am very proud to be on a alt-right list of woke game designers who are ruining the industry. I am thrilled by this. The amount of money I make has not changed one bit because this list exists.
I've looked at that list occasionally and I'm too small of a potatoes to make it on there, but I'm perfectly fine if I do
Someday,
someday.
Craig, someday. You'll both be on there, I swear.
I'm just not
I
big enough to be
mean,
on anybody's radar.
I think
Right,
that don't
right.
they have like a little message that says like, oh, if you're a woman or you're queer or you're not white, you're also woke, so don't buy a game from them
Oh
too.
yeah, that's right, because they're lazy and they want to do the actual work. That's fair.
Yeah.
I'm already on it technically. Let me
Darn me for being a straight white dude.
I don't think that
I
that's
don't get
actually what happened.
categories that way. For once, you have to work at something. Oh no. Oh no, I have to try. Oh, I've been trying for 10 years.
Great conversation. I think like I love making political games. I'm never gonna stop doing it. I love making games with messages. Even my games that aren't super highly political, like Coven, always has a message in there. Coven's about fighting and being powerful girls, teenage girls. And that's not necessarily political, but it's sociological. And I struggle a lot when I'm trying to write something and I don't have that message to like really hook into until I get that like that message. I,
It's
yeah, it's
very
hard.
true. Yeah, there's it can be a guiding principle. It can be a force that impels you and helps you make decisions. Like, what should I do for this thing? Well, this game is about this thing, so this is what I should do. Like
Right. Yeah.
that follows. And I have found in my own game designs that, and it doesn't even have to be like the messages. It just, it certainly can be. But like having guiding principles, having things like this game is about XYZ, or it's about it's about these things, and those become informational to you. Those become decision makers for you. Like, I've had a couple of different games where I thought I was going a certain direction with the game, and then I kind of realized, well, now that I've got it, this much of it written, and there's players have played it and they've told me what they've taken away from it, and I'm like, oh, this game is about this. And I hadn't really recognized that before. And then then you decide whether you're going to lean into that or not. And more often than not, it's more interesting to lean into having a message than it is to
And
try to purposely create something that is devoid of any sort of leaning. That's hard. That's really hard.
one thing that's distinctive to design, since we're kind of trying to focus on that part here, is that when you're running a game, the game begins and ends within the game space, so you can adapt very quickly. The design, you have a much longer phase, and so when the world changes, that can impact the message you intended to the game. I worked on Trinity Continuum Anima. We pitched the game 2019 as a cyberpunky game, and so yeah, I love literary cyberpunk, and I want to do a cyberpunk game that's closer to the ideals of first wave literary cyberpunk rather than necessarily the kind of gestalt of what we think cyberpunk gaming is now by people's perceptions of a very specific brand of Shadowrun and cyberpunk, right? It's like, cool, I want to dig into this. I want to dig into people and the relationships with alternate reality and the loneliness of living in a brand new space where there's no culture to live with, but you're kind of isolated and what that isolation feels like. And then I got the game together and I hired the team and we started writing and then COVID hit. And we had to have a team meeting to say, okay, by the time this game comes out, people are going to have a very different opinion about what it's like to be isolated and how to connect to people.
Yeah.
So we need to adjust. We didn't change a lot at the end because we were still kind of more or less tapped in. But like, for example, we had a slightly different place of how police and security worked in the world. And then when the June 2020 riots happened, it's okay, we're gonna pull that back a bit harder, go a little harder on the anti-fascism message here. We're gonna go a slightly different direction with it to really button this down because our message is changing under us as we work on this. We're lucky that we happened to tap into things that were really relevant in that year. But it did mean that also the team working on it were really anxious during it because it's like, I don't know if I want to write about this because I'm living it right now. And it's like, if you need to get off, I understand. But also, this is exactly the right time to be doing it because it's hot and it's emotional right now. And I got probably some of the best writing out of some of these people. I mean, they're all fantastic writers, but even more because they were feeling it, because they were in it, and because they saw that message in a way that I don't think they always saw working on a role-playing game. So that to me was very much like a great moment of designing with the message, but also that changed in the course of making it. And sometimes those things happen when you're designing a game.
Eddie, we have to wrap up, and I think that's a great
No.
place to leave it on. Thanks for joining us today. This was a great conversation.
I am always happy to talk about this kind of stuff. I'm always happy to be on this podcast. I enjoy doing
Yay, thank you.
it.
Where can we find you and your stuff, Eddie?
Right now the best way to find me on social media, I have decided Blue Sky is the current my choice for that. So you can find me there at pugsteady.com. That's also my website if you want to find all of the books I've worked on. I have worked on apparently at this point in time over 200 books. So find some that you like. But if you want to support something that gives me money directly, as opposed to something I've worked as a freelancer on, realmsofpugmire.com takes you to my silly, not at all political game about dogs. Feel free to check it out.
Awesome. You can find me also on Blue Sky. I'm there at Josca. You can find my games at wannabegames.com. Go to my itch page. Go to wannabegames.itch.io. Go to DriveThruRPG. We're getting new copies of some of our games. I have a second edition of the Covenant PS13 coming out soon with just some updated rules, just some little updated rules. So if you want those updated rules and you already have the game, send me a message and I will give you a free copy of the updated PDF because I changed some stuff I didn't like. So I just fixed it. But yeah, you can find my stuff there.
And I'm at Nerdburger Craig on the various social medias. My website is nerdburgergames.com. The games are all on DriveThruRPG. And then like the fancy hardcovers are on the web store as well and cost the same as the print on demand versions. For now, ha.
Right, I'm about to say at
Yeah, for
the
now.
And I'm still barreling toward a Kickstarter for Slay to Win on tentatively set for May 6th. And that is an occasionally cooperative monster hunting light role-playing card game where you're all killing monsters and saving the kingdom. And being wonderful heroes, but you also all secretly want to be the best monster hunter ever. So you have to get that killing blow, or you won't earn the points, the trophy points to become the best.
Yes. Thank you to Steph Sachs for opening and closing theme song, which is Ava, licensed under Creative Commons. And thank all of you for listening.
Yeah.
And we'll see you back here next time. Bye.
Bye. Bye, guys.